Right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Me, Myself and Hopefully You podcast. I'm your host, Tariq, a 19-year-old university student currently experiencing a midlife crisis as he has no idea what he wants to do with his life. So rather than see a career advisor or a therapist, I decided to start a podcast where I invite guests from an array of backgrounds to tell me their story. And whilst finding out about them, hopefully I can find out more about myself too. So if you can relate, or maybe you just want to see where I end up, join me every Sunday right here. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest at this time is a former Wall Street vice president turned author, coach and keynote speaker with a passion for helping others grow. He spent decades on Wall Street, including during the 9/11 attacks and the 2008 financial crash. During this time on Wall Street, he became a vice president and an award-winning sales executive. John tells me more of how he grew to such high prominence in one of the most competitive fields, what it was like being in New York when the Twin Towers fell, what really happened during the 2008 crash, and so much more. I hope you enjoy this podcast as much as I did. So join me in welcoming my guest at this time, John Saunders. So, John, just to sort of start off and just for everyone to get to know you a bit more, I'm just going to ask you three quick fire questions. My first one is completely random. What is the last thing that's on your camera roll?
The last thing that's on my camera roll. Interesting. A picture. So you're talking about my phone, right?
Yeah.
a picture. I took my kids for a hike yesterday and I got a picture of them out in this trail we were on not far from here by the Potomac River.
Oh, nice. Fair enough. I mean, I love walking as well. It's the best thing ever, especially if it's a nice day.
Getting outside, especially in this pandemic world we live in, is, I think, you know, it's hard to do, but to get out in the sort of in the woods and go for a hike is one, there's not many people around, so it's kind of safe. And I think it just helps to kind of clear your mind and get a little fresh air.
Yeah, I bet. Because you're located in, I mean, I don't know what the geography in Bethesda, United States is like, but I bet there's probably some really nice places just to go on a walk with your kids or by yourself. And just like, I remember during the pandemic, especially at the beginning, I was doing 20,000 steps a day every day because I had nothing else to do. But it was brilliant. My next question is, if you can, and you can all, you have to tell me, give me an answer on this one. Who would you say is your biggest role model in life?
Interesting. And I've had so many in life.
Everyone says that, yeah.
Yeah, I've had so many people that I've learned from over the years. You know, there's a gentleman I've been spending a fair amount of time with in the last several months, probably 6 to 12 months. His name is Jose Perez. He's a global innovation consultant. And as I've been trying to build my little global innovation consulting coaching business, he's been a great mentor to me and a really fantastic model to follow after.
Brilliant. And is there a particular sort of thing that you resonate with him that makes him your role model?
I think we're both very like-minded in the sense that very creative, come up with tons of ideas, but just because he's been through this journey for the last 20 years that I've been going on for the last year or so, he's just really helpful and willing to get down to the nitty gritty of like the nuts and bolts of every aspect of trying to grow this business, from how to develop clients to how to price meetings to how to market yourself. I mean, you name it. We've gotten into every aspect of the discussion and he models this behavior every day in his business. He's a really impressive man and very gracious with his time.
I think it's really good, especially when it's someone that you can still sort of interact with and speak with and work alongside as much as possible, because then you're still learning from them. And you consider them as a role model, it's the perfect situation.
If you think about, if you ever want to figure out how, if you want to go down a certain road and figure it out, go talk. I mean, it sounds simple, but people don't do it. Go ask someone who's done it.
Yeah, exactly. It's the best way. I've heard that so many times, but it's true. My third and final quick fire question is, say there was a house fire, yeah, and everyone survived, but you could only keep one item, what would that item be?
Man, so all my family got out.
Yeah.
And I have a painting. I have a painting in my house that's really the marquee piece of artwork in my house, and it's of the south of France of a vineyard. Wow. And I really like that painting. And of course, if it was burned, you know, it's a one of a kind, it would be lost forever. So I would probably grab that.
Oh, wow. So what's a painting of?
It's literally a vineyard in the south of France. It's this beautiful, it's this beautiful hillside going up to the winery on the top of the hill, and all the wine, the vines coming down the hill. It's beautiful.
Oh, how did you acquire that?
Yeah, I was living in, at the time, Central Florida, Orlando. And there was a really beautiful hotel in the middle of the city, and attached to it was a Starbucks. And inside the hotel was an art gallery, and many times they'd bring their artwork into the Starbucks as kind of a way to market it in case you didn't make it into the gallery. And I walked in one day, and they had this gentleman featured. Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting his name right now. Something anyway, it was one of those things where every piece of artwork, I was like, oh my God, I love all of these. As I walked into the gallery, and then there were a bunch more, and I brought my wife in, and we looked at a bunch and picked one. And it's the centerpiece of our home in many ways, the artwork.
Oh, wow. Very nice.
Post-impressionistic style.
Nice. So, I mean, if you're not comfortable with answering this, it's fine. How much did you pay for this painting?
It was not an inexpensive painting.
Right. Okay. Oh, fair enough. All right. Well, I mean, if you love it that much, it's even better. So before we sort of get with the questions, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience, John?
Sure. I grew up in Wisconsin, which is the middle of America, a little north of Chicago for a reference point. Always was very aware of investing. My parents got me into investing very young. In fact, they bought me an investment when I was 3 or 4 years old. They put $1,000 in a mutual fund, and I still own it today, which is like 43, 44 years later. It's gone up 110 times.
Jeez.
Which, you know.
Yeah, play to your parents.
People often ask me, like, how do you make an investment go up 100 times? You're like, well, buy it and buy a quality investment and sit on it for 40 years. There's the secret. So it's kind of fun. So my whole life, I was very in this, you know, I was always very aware of investing. My dad was always reading the Investor's Business Daily, Barron's, Financial Times, things like this. And so it was just kind of always around me. So when I got into school, college, I went to school out in Wisconsin. I really wanted to get into financial services in some way, shape, or form. And then I also always was intrigued by New York and Wall Street. And so when I got done with school, an opportunity popped up out there. So I moved to New York, spent over 23 years with a firm on Wall Street. Started out as a sales assistant. 23 years later, was running a $4 billion a year business for the firm, which was just really fun, leading a team of amazing sales executives. And then we got sold in 2019 to a big competitor. I was offered a pretty good deal to leave. And so I took that to leave. And, you know, during that sort of time off, I said, what should I do? What do I want to do when I grow up? You know, what is me 7.0 look like, or 8.0, whatever it might be. And in fact, I wrote a book, which was really an exciting journey, The Optimizer, building and leading a team of serial innovators. And that has transformed into just a number of interesting opportunities with coaching and consulting and speaking engagements, which has been super fun.
I mean, it's a pretty hectic and crazy sort of story in its own way, I guess, because it's sort of a lot about, and there's a lot of finance involved in that story, which is a particular reason why I got you on. In the book, The Optimizer, you have a story right at the beginning that you mentioned that sort of opened you up to the rest of the of your life so far. Why don't you tell us a bit more about that story?
Sure. So I was about 3 or 4 years into the job, and I was maybe 25, 26 years old, and I was feeling a bit stalled. I had gone for a couple of promotions, got passed by, and, you know, if there's anything I've learned in life is when things don't go your way, instead of being angry and, you know, getting upset and running, you know, a lot of people, I had other friends that had the same thing, and they just left the company and said, you know what, I'm going to try something else out. And they were angry about it. And I decided to try a little bit harder and seek some advice and counsel. So gentleman in the company, Michael Keough is his name, said, you know, and I want to get on his team. Joining his team would have been a promotion. And I've been turned down once or twice already. And he said, you need to have a more well-rounded skill set. And I said, you know, well, how do I do that if I don't get this new job, right? I sort of have the job I have. You know, how do I gain new experience if I'm still in my old job? And he said, why don't you go find some work outside the company as a volunteer, maybe join, do some, philanthropic work, something like this. I thought, that's interesting. So I started searching around, and at a party one night, met this gentleman who ran a film festival in New York City. It was called the New York Underground Film Festival, a very independent art film festival. And I started talking to him, and I said, how do you guys do fundraising and get sponsors for your event? And he said, you know, quite frankly, we could use a little help with that. And I said, well, you know, I think I could help you out with that and go do sales and fundraising. So I joined up with him. The first year came in a bit late, so I didn't get very far. I sold a couple ads, didn't get much traction, but I built up a pretty good lead list and slowly figured out how you really get these deals done. I was calling marketing departments, and what I learned was that you really needed to call the companies often hired public relations teams to get this done. And it took me several steps and lots of questions to figure that out. And once I did, that's when it worked. So I ended up getting in this film festival was around for 19, 20 years. The year that I worked with them there, or the second year, I should say, was the only year they ever had a title sponsor. And it was Jameson Irish Whiskey, which is created not too far from, much closer to where you're sitting than I am. And they were kind enough to give us not only the money for the full title sponsor, so the event was, you know, with their name on the banner, and 22 cases of Jameson Irish Whiskey, which is,
wow,
that's a lot of whiskey.
It's a lot of whiskey and great for a festival.
And we somehow managed to make it all disappear. I probably had a case left at the end, which I gave out to people that helped, you know, volunteer and whatnot. But taking that experience, getting outside of my comfort zone and looking at the world through this new lens, because, you know, Wall Street versus independent film festival, two totally different universes. So it gave me this whole new lens on how to approach people and frame a message and make a compelling story. And it helped me reframe what I did on Wall Street. So I took this new knowledge back to Wall Street and how I approached people and framed things. And really, months later, the next opportunity came up for a promotion. I landed it, and boy, my career really took off from there. After feeling very stalled for probably six or 12.
I feel like that's something that a lot of people can relate, even if you're not particularly in a career or anything like that, especially during this pandemic. A lot of people almost have sat back and they feel like their life has come to a halt, that everything has come to a halt. They can't increase their wage. Some people don't even have a wage coming in right now. They can't develop them, or they feel like they can't develop themselves or learn anything. And it's interesting because it's sort of the age old question of how am I going to get experience if I haven't got experience? Because you apply for a job and they go, well, what experience have you got? And you go, I've got none. Well, then how are you going to ever get it? But sort of the way that you did it was you went, well, someone had told you that you need to expand your skill set, like you said, and you went out, you volunteered in something quite radical compared to what you were currently doing, a film festival, you know, compared to, you know, Wall Street, completely different. And, you know, you learned these new sort of skills, which, you know, you said, we'll get onto how it sort of propelled your career. I think it's something that a lot of people can relate to, even though my audience is a lot younger than probably you having that sort of job or anything. They're all at university or they're trying to find out what they want to do next. It is very, very relatable.
Well, I'll tell you, I appreciate that. In the current day and age, this book that I wrote, it's a very similar story, but fast forward, you know, from 25 years old to 45 years old, and 46, 47, whatever, wherever, I forgot how old I was when I started writing it. But in the last year or two, I started writing it. Honestly, the story is almost identical, but in the sense that I'm getting totally outside of my comfort zone. I'd never written a book before. I'm not known as a writer or anything like this. A friend, as I was going through this career change I talked about earlier, a friend said, Kamal Bhatia is his name. He said, why don't you go write a paper, put it on LinkedIn or something to promote yourself? And I thought, that's a good idea. So I wrote this paper, shared it with a friend. He said, why don't you make this into a series and put it out over 4 weeks? And I thought, I like that idea, kind of stretch out the marketing runway, if you will. Shared it with another friend who, as I learned, helped executives get published for a living. So, you know, I'm creating this thing. I keep telling people about it and people keep offering to help me, which was great. And then I finally take it to a professor at my business school. And he said, I think you have the makings of a book here. And I said, man, I've always thought about writing a book, but where do you even start? And he introduced me to a guy that is an author coach, runs an organization called the Creator Institute. And boy, if you would have, I would never have bet money that when I was writing that paper a year later, you know, I started writing the paper late, you know, it was late 19, the book published late 20. Tariq, I never would have bet money that I would have had a number one new release on Amazon. I never would have bet on that. And sure enough, I did. It was really incredible. And now just going through this creative process and telling people about it, it's just opened so many new doors to me.
Well, it's like just sort of, I mean, it's sort of just trying and just starting is the most important thing. And once you get that ball rolling, it becomes easier because you went from just writing one, you know, piece to put on your LinkedIn. And it got a little bit of recognition, and one person out of that recognition helped you a bit more, and then so on and so forth. And then it became a book because you continued doing it. And it's only because you started and it got it rolling that it's become what it is now, a book that's done really well. And again, it's something else that's quite relatable to myself and other people, that it's just about going out there and getting started.
You know, a friend of mine plays basketball a lot, and he played in college and things like this. And he was sort of looking at what I've done over the last couple of years, trying to figure out this new business. And he said, you know, you just keep moving your feet. And I guess you could make the real sort of a similar argument for football or soccer, as we call it in this country, right? Just keep moving and trying different things. And there was this woman I met in summer of 19 who gave me this great advice. I said, if you're thinking about making your career change, you know, how would you think about it? What would you do? And she, honestly, all these stories I've shared so far, she really helped sort of pull them all together. And she said, just go try to immerse yourself in something. So you said earlier, people kind of feel stuck and sort of powerless and pandemic and all of these things. There's so many things going on right now in the world. You can jump on webinars for just about anything. And so much of it's free. It's unbelievable how much free content there's out there these days.
Oh yeah.
And she said, go immerse yourself in something and your value proposition will manifest itself. And I remember thinking, what is she talking about? I had no idea what she was talking about. And as I did that, you know, certainly the paper appeared, then the book appeared, and now all these speaking engagements have appeared. It's been just extraordinary. But you could take that same little immerse yourself story and apply it to all these transformative times in my life where I just really embraced something for a good period of time. And, you know, people start to recognize, like with the guy with the volunteer at the film festival work I did, volunteering there, you know, he said, oh, here's a guy who could help us raise money. You know, I'm good at tracking people down and getting access to the right person and asking tons of questions till I get to the right person and then, you know, getting them to commit. So again, like this immersing yourself in something interesting, creating something, as in the case with the book, you know, actually the program I went through, it has a lot of the people in the program are in their 20s.
Oh, wow.
Some of them are even students. So I'm actually kind of one of the old guys in the program, although they're trying to expand it more to people like me. But most of the people in the program are in their 20s.
So what is this program?
It's called the Creator Institute. So it's an author coaching program. They take you through this. They launch every 4 months. There's a new cohort. My cohort was about 200 people. And they ranged from the youngest person in there was probably 19 or 20. And the oldest was probably in their 50s. And they take you through a weekly online class where they teach you how to write, how to be an author, how to write like an author, not like you write a paper for, you know, some college class or something. It's a much different style of writing. So they teach you how to write like an author. And you spend 6 months creating your manuscript and they have deadlines for you, which is great. You get an editor, which is, I don't know how you write a book without an editor, quite frankly. They help you, you know, stay sort of in between the guidelines of what they're coaching you to. And then after 6 months, if they introduce you to a publisher and you can go with the publisher they recommend or not, they make it really easy to do. So I did that. And then they pick up coaching on the revision stage, which you spend another 5 months doing. And then at the end of really about 11, 12 months, you've literally, as long as you follow the guidelines and get everything done, you have a book.
Oh, brilliant. So it's like they just sort of guided you throughout that whole process, a process which, obviously, from the beginning, it probably seems quite daunting, you know, the idea of writing a book. How am I going to write? It's going to take me ages. They almost act as a mentor to get you through that process of writing it so that you can get to the publishing stage and go, here, I've got my book. What do you think of it?
Yeah. And if it's the publisher's really good in that they look at it and, you know, if it's, they need it to be at a certain standard for them to even take it on. Yeah. So if it's not, they'll let you know and they'll give you a chance to fix it. And you don't have to, but you know, I believe me, this book went through an insane amount of revisions. Great books. What is it? Good books are written. Great books are rewritten is I think the phrase they like to use.
Is that you calling your own book a great book, John?
No. I'm quoting the coach in the class. But yeah, thank you for checking me on that one. I appreciate that.
No. I'm sure it is a great book. I can't wait to buy it. Especially after this podcast. It is a great book. You need to tell everyone it's a great book, John. You can't just say it.
It is a great book. Thank you.
It is a great book. I'll edit that out for you. Don't worry. I'm joking. Nothing gets edited. Just to carry on from your journey, there is you and about whole the whole idea of immersing yourself is you spent two decades, I think it was around 2 decades, as a Wall Street senior vice president. Now, when I hear that title, I'm thinking, bloody hell, this is pretty amazing. What does this entail? These are such amazing words, you know, Wall Street vice president, and then you know, for 20 years, that's pretty incredible. How did you get to that point? That role.
Yeah. So right out of school, to talk a little bit about the early part of the story, I started out at the company as a sales assistant. I mean, you know, one of those jobs you graduate from college and you move to New York City where the cost of living is insane, not unlike London or any big city in the world. And, you know, I was making $26,000, which was, I would say, below the poverty line of New York City in the late 90s. Yeah. And I had this shoebox of an apartment in Manhattan. And, you know, to me, it was all about just working harder. I would show up early. I would stay late. I always asked for more responsibility. I mean, it sounds simple, but that was literally my roadmap. And as you get promoted once, twice, three times, you know, the competition, the spaces are fewer, right? There's fewer roles to move into as you move up. So at some point, you have to start working a bit smarter and not just harder, right? And, you know, I was sort of learning these things as I went, but the key themes were 1, working harder, 2, always looking for more responsibility. So whenever I had a review with my boss, for example, I would say, hey, if there's an opportunity to, give me a chance to sort of take on the role of someone in the job ahead of me that I want, I'd love that opportunity. And so I was always putting that sort of thought in my manager's ear. So fast forward to probably around the time of the film festival, they called me up and they said, hey, I got called by the head of my department. And they said, hey, we need someone to go to Florida. I was living in Manhattan at the time, as I said. They said, we have a conference in Florida and we don't have anyone to do the speaking slot for us. So could you go do that? And honestly, I thought they were kidding. But because I'd asked, hey, if you have one of these opportunities, I'd love to take it. So they came to me with that request. And I said, sure. Honestly, I thought they were kidding. I didn't think they were going to send a 25-year-old to Florida to go speak in front of 300 or 400 people as a keynote speaker at a conference. Yeah. And sure enough, I did it. And boy, I was nervous as all get out. But getting out of my comfort zone, really, you know, that they saw me go. I had good reviews from the clients that saw me there. And then suddenly my company started looking at me differently, right? Hey, here's someone who's actually delivering. So I practiced that presentation. I bet you 50 to 100 times before I delivered it for that audience. I'm not kidding you. I really wanted to make sure it was good.
What was the presentation on?
It was like the stock market investing and the history of investing. It was kind of our general market overview presentation.
Right.
So when I think about my career and how I sort of got to where I was, it was almost every inflection point was about getting outside my comfort zone. So I did that, did the film festival work. Then I landed an outside sales job finally in the DC kind of area where I am now, but this is back in 2001, around then. And then that job was crazy. I was on the road. I think I did, in those 2 years, I think I did 150 something like hotel nights. I'm not in 2 years, like 150, 200 hotel nights.
Wow.
If people who haven't spent time on the road, they might not appreciate that. And you are basically living in hotels like Monday or Tuesday through Friday. And, you know, going home on the weekends just to wash your clothes, like go do it again.
Yeah.
And so I did that for 2 years. The company then had a very small territory. They like to give small ones to young people like me at the time. So it was a really, it was a very low performing territory. That's why it opened up. It was kind of, the company did a bit of a reorg to try to sort of get it turned around, and they offered the opportunity to me. Well, they didn't offer it. I applied for it and got it, and I moved to Orlando, and I covered Central Florida and Puerto Rico for about, 12 years. And again, just kept pushing on this, working harder, working harder, working harder. Then eventually started to try to work a little bit smarter. And said, you know what, I really want to get into leadership at some point. So I started going to grad school down there in Orlando, in a town called Winter Park, which is a little suburb of Orlando.
What is grad school? I've heard this term so many times.
Like business school, like MBA, master's degree, this kind of thing.
Oh, okay. So like postgraduate. Well,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. So, I just wanted to know what that was.
Sure. So I go, I apply to school down there, and at the same time, the senior vice president role opened up, and I'd been a very successful sales guy now for a number of years. And let me back up just a hair, because there's an interesting story in here that I passed over. As a sales guy, I will say for 5 or 6 years, my business took off very nicely, and I was working super hard, and you know, the business was really in bad shape, so it was easy to show early growth. 5, 6 years go by, and now I'm kind of plateauing. So I'm not growing anymore. I'm kind of going sideways. And yeah. I'm sitting at this conference, the year-end conference, where they give out awards. And the award I could have won, they come up to announce the person's name. You know, this is a room filled with 250, 300 people. It's our executive conference for the year. And they said the person's name that won. And up until that moment, Tariq, I thought I had a chance. And as soon as I said the guy's name, I realized I wasn't even in the running. I was just deluding myself. And there's a famous quote I love. It's in my book, The Worst Lies We Tell to Ourselves, right? I was deluding myself.
So why? Were you deluded? What had happened?
I appreciate you asking that. Because I had 5 or 6 great years, I had a couple trophies I'd won. So I had these awards on my shelf. So as I was getting more complacent and not focusing so much on growth, I kept saying, oh, it's some external force that's causing me to have these, you know, sort of mediocre years. How could I be wrong? I have these trophies sitting on my shelf right here. Well,
ego had been built up, and now someone's pushing you down. Give me some fair competition.
And these trophies, right. And these trophies were getting more and more dust on them. But of course, you know, I didn't want to admit that it was me not working as hard. Because I had these trophies, I thought it's something else. And that moment when that guy won the award and I didn't, it hit me. Oh my God, this is me. I have been slacking off the last year or two, and it's showing up in my results. It's not an external force, it's me. And so the guy who won the big award that year, Ian Roche is his name. I went, as soon as the award ceremony was over, I ran up to him and I said, hey, did you do something differently this year to really have this great year yet? So they have all these awards, but there's one big award. He won the big award. So I asked him, and he said, yeah, I went out and surveyed my best relationships on what it's like working with me and how I could be a better partner to them in the future. And I thought, that's brilliant. Who does that? This is 2011 or so now. And
even now, I don't think people do that.
It is not something people do very often.
It's ballsy. It's very ballsy.
You're putting yourself out there. You're putting yourself in a very vulnerable position, because you might not like what people have to say about you, but this is how you grow. And so I went and surveyed. I got his survey, took it to about 12 or 15 of my favorite clients' relationships and asked them these questions. And I can promise you a bunch of that insight was not information I wanted to hear, because it made me feel really... One example was I asked this guy I've known for years, and I said, what's it like working with me? Or what's your favorite part about working with my company? And Tariq, I'll never forget thinking, this is where he tells me how great I am. I'm not kidding you. That's exactly what I thought he was going to say. He didn't mention my name once in that answer. And I was like, oh my God.
Oh man, that must be some punches to the stomach.
It hurt. But it helped me have this, you don't get these moments of awareness unless you put yourself out there. And it made me realize as I left his office that day that this is what brand management is about. How do you manage your brand? Your brand, Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO, famously said is, have you heard this quote?
I think so.
He said, it's what people say about you when you're not in the room.
Yeah, I have heard that. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, that quote just hit me right in the head that day, because I realized I wasn't managing my brand very well with this client. And so took all this insight from him and a bunch of other people, tweaked my business plan that year, and went out and executed. And 1 year later, I had this blowout year I took a designation that year, a professional designation, so some little initials behind my name. And so refined my business plan with this insight, took a designation, had a blowout year myself. I sat on that stage a year later and won that big award. And that was my launch into the senior vice president role. That gave me, that's a very prestigious award at my firm. And that was really the big catapult for me.
Wow. So, I mean, you mentioned there about how your clients weren't necessarily happy working with you. And that particular client never even mentioned your name when you told him that, you know, what was the best thing working with me. Do you think that at that point in time, you weren't a particularly nice person to work with, or was it just, you know, I know I'm asking you to punch yourself here, but, you know, I just want to know more about that.
I wouldn't say it was so much about not being, it wasn't so much about me going from being sort of a jerk to a good person. It was more about figuring out just how I could be more valuable to them. And that's really what it was about. I think people generally would say it was pleasant or easy to work with me. I think that would be a fair statement. In fact, most of the feedback people gave me was, and this really blew my mind, you know, what do you find good about working with me? You're consistent. You call me back within a reasonable amount of time. You're well-informed. You show up regularly. I mean, to me, these are table stakes. And I remember thinking when I heard that feedback so many times, probably from every person I interviewed, you know, a dozen or more people. And I remember thinking, man, the bar is low. Show up, be organized, know your material, you know, call people back in a reasonable amount of time. I mean, I remember thinking, wow, this is almost ridiculous. Like, the bar is low.
That's both a good thing and a bad thing, I guess, for people. Because it's like, well, it's sad that the bar is that low, but then it's good because it's like, you genuinely have to do just a bit over the bare minimum and people will love it.
Yeah, so when you do, well, and, you know, in the defense of these people that were getting talked about in this way, you know, your company is demanding a lot of you. So they're asking you to run 100 miles an hour. Mm. So it's easy to kind of lose track of, you're meeting with so many clients and getting calls from so many clients every day. You know, it's not hard to lose track of stuff. So it was actually it made me feel good realizing that the systems and sort of my level of organization was getting recognized by my clients. So it was really more about, what did you like about working with me? What's been a positive, you know, what I like to call I didn't come up with this name, but start, stop, continue. What should I start doing? What should I stop doing? Because you don't see value in it. And what should I continue to do that you already are enjoying about working with my relationship? And so start was often, hey, what are my competitors doing that I'm not doing? Or where do you see value out there that I could provide that I'm not? And I remember another guy, I did this huge event for him every year. I spent a lot of money from my own budget on it, marketing budget that we had. And, you know, there's a lot of time, money, and resources for me to get this thing done. He didn't see a whole lot of value in it. So quite frankly, I took that resource and gave it to another client because he just didn't see the value. Yeah. So there was a lot of learning. And, you know, again, it allowed me to say, oh, I need to start doing this. I need to stop doing that. And I need to continue on this organized process I developed for sort of I tried to be very intentional about how I touched my clients, if you will, through email, face-to-face, phone calls, very organized and structured. And they didn't know that it was mapped out so succinctly, but that's what was happening behind the scenes. And it was cool to see them recognize, you know, they said, you always seem like you're around, but not too much. And you're well-organized. Like, that was a very consistent theme. And I really appreciated that.
Like, you're a constant friendly face, but that isn't just in your face as that you don't want someone that's constantly bombarding you with emails, calls, and, you know, pointless meetings. So you it seems like you were sort of, so what was that sort of thought process in terms of, you know you sort of said that there was a variety of, you know, calls, emails, face-to-face, whatever. What was your thought process behind all that as to how you would engage with a client?
So looking at a whole calendar year, what I would do is we had our big kickoff meeting in January. So kind of, hey, here's the company would come to us and give us all these new insights. Here's our view for the year. Here's what we think is happening. So I would go to my best clients and meet with them or call them before that meeting and say, hey, I'm going to go talk to all these, you know, portfolio managers, these people that manage billions of dollars for our organization, you know, some of the greatest minds on Wall Street. I would call them before the meeting and say, hey, is there something you would like me to ask these people specifically? That you'd like to get sort of a behind the curtain scene view of what's going on. And so I'd get these questions from my clients. And then I would schedule, before I even went on that trip, wherever we would go, it was always somewhere different. I would schedule time with my clients immediately following that meeting. So I would come home from that meeting on a Friday or a Saturday, whatever, and I would go see these people on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So to answer your question directly, coming out of that meeting, I would go see my best clients right after that meeting, oftentimes coming back with very specific questions, comments, concerns they had that I got right from the, you know, the source, if you will. And then they would see me. Then in February, the first week of the second month of the quarter, which sounds a little bit too detailed, but is very specific. I did that because it would take a long time to get our literature all updated. In Wall Street, you have to update your literature and financial services every quarter. So usually by February 2nd or 3rd, it would be updated. So the first Wednesday and Thursday, I'd have a portfolio manager come down and we'd do a roadshow to tell a very specific story. We'd go out and promote a particular product or idea. And then, so they'd see a weekly email from me. They'd see a quarterly portfolio manager meeting with me. They'd see my face every 6 weeks. And it was just on this constant cycle. And every Monday for 10 or 12 years, I sent out an email every single Monday. It's hard to, like, I did that literally for, I bet, 10 years. And so they saw a brand. I had the same name. The email was very consistent. It was very simple. I didn't want to overwhelm them with information. And then I'm forgetting one step of my story. Oh, I would send them handwritten thank you notes at the end of every month. Hey, thank from my top clients. Hey, thanks for all the business this month. And my handwriting is terrible. So they knew that it was definitely for me. I wasn't paying someone to do that. They're like, no one would pay someone to do this badly. I got that feedback one time.
What in the survey? Yeah, your writing is awful. I don't understand these notes. What are these notes you're sending me? They can't even understand the thank you. They're just like, they're just paper that you keep giving me. I don't understand.
Right.
No. So, I mean, that's quite, so what would these emails, these emails every Monday, would they just be sort of an update of what you're going to do this week or?
It was more about, we had a pretty well-known chief economist and he would put out this weekly kind of snapshot of the market. And it was a one-page thing. So people liked it. It was very quick. You could look at it and get a real quick summary of kind of what was happening in the stock market that week and the bond market.
Okay.
So I would send that out. And then so it would always be that one pager, if you will, and then one other product typical thing or whatever I was trying to focus on with my clients. But it was about being very consistent and intentional. Some people take this sort of scattershot approach. Like I'm going to throw as much information at you as I can and hopefully some of it sticks. I tried to be very targeted with, hey, this year, you know, you're only going to hear about these handful of stories from me. It's not going to be 50 different things. And I think people really appreciated that. And it helps build your credibility instead of just constantly throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. You know, hey, this is what I think should stick. Here's why. You're going to keep hearing this story from me. I'll bring the portfolio manager down later this year. You know, it was just a real consistent building process.
Well, quite like, especially, I mean, it was effective, you know, then, and I'm sure it's even more effective now because we are in a phase of overload of information these days where we're getting so much, we're subscribed to so many different sort of newsletters, etc. And we're getting all these emails constantly on a constant basis. I think things like, you know, sending your email on a Monday, that the client knowing that they're getting that on the Monday, and then also knowing that at the end, or maybe not knowing, but sort of all of a sudden at the end of the month getting a thank you note, something like that. Because I mean, a lot of businesses, you know, they might give a bonus on Christmas, or you know, your employer might give you a thank you note on Christmas or your birthday or whatever. But for it to constantly happen and to be handwritten, I think that's the big thing. And it goes back to how low down the bar is. The handwritten note would have meant so much to these clients, and it would have just sort of added a little, you know, maybe not a metric value to anything, but a little sort of goodness and happiness to the relationship you had with them.
It was a personal,
yeah.
It was a very personal touch, and I raced. So the second the month ended, I would sit down and write those notes like that night. So if, you know, and March 31st or whatever date, whatever month it was, they would have that note within a day or two. And so they knew it was, and sometimes it was through the weekend. So I would write it on a Friday night, ship it on a Saturday. Sometimes I'd get it on the mail on Monday or Tuesday. And so I actually got a call from a top client saying, you had to have written this over the weekend to get this to me so fast. And he was super impressed by that.
Mm.
And, you know, it was just, and I always try to make it very personalized and thoughtful, not just, you know, generic. I always try to personalize it. And those little touches, it's a lost art. It really is. Mm. And people forget about that stuff in this world of digital everything and, you know, internet and what email, whatever. writing someone a handwritten note is a big deal. It's
oh yeah, 100%. It's just like you said, it adds a personal touch, a human element when an email is so easy. I mean, even an email people would probably appreciate, but a handwritten note means so much more. So to carry on the sort of conversation of your experiences there, I mean, actually, let's get to the point where, so is this the point where you are actually senior vice president? Are you doing all this whilst you're senior vice president?
The handwritten notes, that whole story, that was all when I was a vice president and a field sales person. And then actually this is to take your segue, I think if I have where you're going, is I did this feedback loop thing that catapulted me into the, that helped my business grow, created this opportunity for me to become a leader. actually, winning that big award offered me the chance to lead a team as a sales guy. So leading my peers on a committee on this advisory board, okay. I was invited to join because I won that award. And then that opportunity, again, way outside my comfort zone, leading my peers all of a sudden, that actually was a good rehearsal, if you will, or audition to go be a manager. And so I did that. I ran that committee for about a year, and then I got this promotion. And then I went to business school after that, graduate school.
So what year did you become a senior VP? VP?
2014.
2014, okay. So before you became senior VP, sorry, you were in Wall Street and you were working in that area. And obviously one of the biggest things to sort of affect Wall Street in the last 20 years or so was, 9/11. And you were there. So what were your experiences on, what were you specifically doing at the time around 9/11, and what was your experience like on that day?
Yeah, that was, it's hard to believe it's been 20 years, but that's a day you'll just never forget if you live through it.
I wasn't born, by the way, right, when it happened. Just so you know, I was born 2 days later, so that might be even more weird, yeah.
So I worked in that building. So when I moved from Wisconsin to New York City, I worked in 2 World Trade Center for 5 years. And then I got this promotion in the summer of 01, I think it was, or beginning of 01, moved to Washington, D.C., which, of course, also had a major attack that day at the Pentagon. And then the weekend before 9/11, I was in New York City at a conference. There was a Marriott hotel attached to the World Trade Center. Literally, you could walk in, you didn't have to go outside to get from one to the other. It was attached. Mm-hmm. I was in that hotel at a conference that very weekend, drove home Sunday. So my girlfriend, now wife at the time, drove home Sunday. And then 9/11, I wake up. I was supposed to go to the airport on 9/11, actually, to go to another conference. Wow. And wake up, the building, my mom calls, are you watching the news? I wasn't, because I was trying to get to the airport. I was running around trying to get packed and everything. And my mom said, turn on the news, and there's the World Trade Center on fire. It was hard to believe seeing this, iconic building on fire. So I call a friend. He answered his phone. I called my girlfriend first. It was busy, couldn't get through. Got through to a friend. I could hear all these sirens going off.
Your girlfriend's there, isn't she, at the time?
She was working there.
So in the World Trade Center?
Correct. Yeah.
So the actual building?
She was working in 2 World Trade Center. And
wow. So
she was one subway stop away, and they stopped the train. And it was, she was kind of running late that day. I guess that was her guardian angel making her late to work that day.
Yeah. There's a lot of stories that are like that.
She was, one subway stop away. They stopped the train. You're underground, so you don't know. They never say, they weren't announcing that the World Trade Center was on fire. They said there's police. They always say there's police activity up ahead, is kind of a general announcement they make in New York City subway. And so she realizes, well, I don't know how long this is going to be. I'm just going to walk. I'm like 5 blocks away or something. So I'll just go out and walk. She leaves the train. Her best friend is on the next car over. Total random luck. So they see each other. Go upstairs. Building's on fire. Oh my God. So they don't even go in. Fortunately, they went the other way, where the girlfriend, her girlfriend had her boyfriend's, they went to her girlfriend's boyfriend's workplace of work. And so I sat there all morning calling her over and over and over again, only getting a busy signal. And I watched both towers fall to the ground before I got through to her. And I remember thinking, like, I could see people leaving the building, but nobody would run away. Because who would ever guess the World Trade Center is going to fall down?
Oh, yeah, right? Exactly.
So honestly, I was thinking she's probably standing with a group of people right outside the building waiting for the fire department to come and clean it up. And then I watched, the second tower gets hit and then they both fall down. And I remember thinking, I had no idea if she was in the building or not in the building because I couldn't get a hold of her.
So just to pause you there, when you couldn't get a hold of her,
was it clear to you that it was because the lines were jammed, or was there a part of you that was thinking, could she be dead?
For sure.
So you weren't actually aware whether it was because the lines were jammed or because her phone, you know, obviously she couldn't pick up.
I had no idea. And they were telling people to not leave the building because the Tower 1 got hit first. And so people in Tower 2, they were saying, oh, don't worry about it. Stay in your offices. Fortunately, the company she worked for said, you know what? Let's get out of here and we'll figure this out later. But I didn't know that at the time. But so they evacuated as soon as the first tower got hit. But again, I didn't know. So I'm just calling her and calling her and calling her and calling her. So I ended up calling my sister, who lives out in the Midwest, and saying, can you please try to call her? Because DC to New York, the phone lines were just crazy because, you know, the two places, both attacks. So I called my sister and asked my sister to start calling because I figured the phone lines from Minnesota would be less crowded. And she got through to her mother, actually. My sister got through to my girlfriend's mother, and she hadn't spoken to her either. So it was almost worse finding her. I mean, her mom was in a total panic. It was a chaotic day. And the one thing that helped me was a friend of mine who worked at the company had a sister who worked for CNN. And she got on. So her sister had her come on CNN. So I saw her name pop up on the screen. And I was like, oh, thank God. If she got out, probably a lot of people did. And because she worked close to her in the office. So I still hadn't talked to her at that point. But I watched both towers fall and thinking, oh, my God, how many people do I know in that building? And fortunately, they all got out except for one.
Yeah.
That I knew.
Was it a close friend of yours, or was it just someone that you'd worked with?
I wouldn't call him like a best friend, but someone I knew very well. I saw him every day for years. And he left our company and went to a firm very high up, and the plane hit below him. So he was on a floor above one of the burning where the plane hit.
So he had no chance then.
They just couldn't get out. Yeah.
Wow.
It was crazy.
What was the immediate reaction to that? Before I sort of get onto the topic of how that affected your sort of position at the time and working in finance, what was the sort of immediate reaction as someone that was, you know, almost a New York, you know, that was there and had lived there or worked there for a long time in that, around that area? What was the reaction?
It was sad. I mean, there was 3,000 people dead. So it was really weird having a place I worked all these years become like a massive gravesite, basically, is what it became, right? Because all these people were killed there and the building was just rubble. And that November, I think September 13th, so your birthday, I drove up to New York to see my girlfriend and actually drove her back down to DC where I was living at the time. And man, crossing the Verrazano Bridge, which if people don't know the Verrazano Bridge, that's the big bridge that connects Staten Island to Long Island. And it's one of the best views of New York City. It's from the south tip looking up, and the towers were just gone. And there was just these two huge clouds of smoke that were trailing up the river. And it was just the eeriest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
I bet, yeah.
And then seeing the world just stopped. I mean, no one was on the street. No planes were in the air. You don't notice how many planes are in the air until there are zero. And then all of a sudden a military plane flies over really low and you're like, oh, that you notice, like an F-15 or whatever. It was crazy. So just days and weeks went by, and then the company had to relocate. It was, oh my gosh, it was so many logistical things, but just the tragedy of just these thousands of people dying. And I went up there in November, went back with my girlfriend. We thought, let's go into New York City and try to be a bit supportive of things and go, you know, because the economy was struggling because of, you know, people just abandoning the city. So we went to the city, stayed in a hotel, and kind of had a little weekend. And I'll tell you, we went down by World Trade Center. The smell was something I'll never forget. And this was, you know, 2 months after the fact.
Yeah.
And the smell of all this burning metal and things, it just hit me. I'll never forget that smell. It was disgusting, quite frankly.
After 2 months.
Two months still later. Walking by restaurants that I had eaten at a million times. Yeah. And the tables were set exactly as they were on 9/11, because they were just abandoned. And the windows were all covered in dust. And there were the tables with the silverware and, you know, napkins or whatever. Wow.
It is, you know, I think that we sort of say often when things happen, like, time just stopped. But that is an actual sort of, you know, you can see it there, that time did stop at that point. when the buildings fell down, that everyone just sort of left their utensils and whatever on there and just ran out because for safety. I mean,
it was a very much a time capsule moment. Mm, and I'll tell you, for months, probably a year afterwards, I would just find myself, I would see something or maybe smell something, something would trigger that day for me. And I would find myself in the most random places crying.
Of course, yeah.
Just overwhelmed by the emotions of that day. It was really just crazy.
I think for you in particular, it's really interesting because you had, you know, a huge, strong connection with, you know, the World Trade Center. Obviously, you'd worked there. And then also, you know, you mentioned, you know, you were living in Washington and the Pentagon got hit as well. So for you, you had, you know, almost two different, you know, attacks that had taken place that had really hit home. Going back to Washington, and, you know, when you were sat there, and obviously now you'd known that your girlfriend was safe, was there a part of you that was just thinking, what's next? What if there's going to be something next? Because now it was New York, now it's Washington. It could be something else. I could be near it. What's going to happen?
My brother was living in Ohio at the time, and the conversation I was having with him that day was, yeah, what does happen next? I'm watching all these people walk across the bridges because all the trains were shut down. So people were literally walking home because they couldn't take the subway or the train or whatever. And I remember thinking, oh my God, they're going to attack these bridges. Like, these guys are smart, right? You've seen these multiple attacks they've done in different things over time where they'll attack one place and then launch another bomb when the ambulances show up or something like that. I'd seen stories like that. And I'm watching thousands of people across the Brooklyn Bridge and thinking, oh my God, what if they attacked her? What if she's on the bridge now? I mean, it was, again, hours before I talked to her. And these are all these thoughts that are going through your mind. What's next? What's next? What's next? And I remember talking to my brother and he was saying, why don't you come out here? You know, the coast is getting attacked. He's in the Midwest in Ohio. Why don't you come out here? And I literally thought about picking her up and driving out there, and I ended up not doing it. But yeah, you can't help but think, what's the next bad thing to happen here? It was very scary.
And okay, and to sort of, it's quite annoying and sort of sad that we've got to move on because it's such a crazy point in time, and time did stop. And to think about jobs and careers after that is almost irrelevant because lives were lost, and, you know, people and someone that you knew had died as well. But to move on from that, when it comes to your particular job on Wall Street, what was the effect of that? Because the economy had collapsed, particularly in New York.
Oh, it hurt our business very badly. So we had, you know, 2001 was a terrible year in business. 2002 was a terrible year in business. And, you know, there were, you know, I don't know if we had layoffs, but certainly costs were cut dramatically and some very tough decisions were being made. Unfortunately, around 2003, business started to recover, but it was a tough couple of years in there in terms of thinking, am I going to have a job tomorrow? Because things are getting so bad. So it was painful. And I think our firm was very fortunate through that time, but plenty of firms laid off, you know, hundreds and thousands of people. So there was a lot of pain. I was very fortunate to be with a company that didn't, but it could have happened.
Yeah. And what was your position at the time?
At the time I was kind of a junior external sales guy. So it was maybe my sort of the first outside sort of external sales job.
So as a junior, you would have been more likely to have been laid off if there were layoffs.
Yeah.
It would have been quite scary as well. So again, it's another sort of element of the whole thing of, well, you could lose your job. And there's no worse time to lose your job than when the economy is collapsing bit by bit.
Yeah, good point.
To move on a few more years after that, there was another thing, and it was another sort of huge impact on the world where I guess time did stop here as well, was the 2008 crash. Now, before I ask about how that impacted your job and what that was like, because there's not a lot of people that know, particularly around my age, because, you know, we were five, six years old when it happened. What was it that built up and caused the crash in 2008 that everyone mentions?
It's a good lesson in leverage or borrowing. So people were... The rules got very relaxed on lending money to buy homes and apartments and things like this, mortgages. And
so the government had relaxed rules, or banks had relaxed rules.
Yes. And so people you know, money, you know, I guess the phrase is easy money. It was very easy to access money and buy a home. So you had people that had no business buying one, two, three, four homes with tremendous leverage. And what that means for maybe if people don't know is you had very little money. Maybe you had $10,000 or something like that, and you were able to get hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans based on that little bit of down payment that you had and get these crazy interest-only mortgages, which I shouldn't call them crazy because they do have some value in the world, but the wrong people were buying them. And because what interest-only means is you're exactly what it says. You're not paying down the principal of your mortgage. So if you own, if you owe, say, $300,000 on a house or a condo or whatever, you're only paying the interest. So that $300,000 is still sitting there. And people do this for like short-term solutions. That's what it's kind of designed for. But at the time, people were using that for everything and investing and, you know, owning three or four properties and thinking, oh, I'll just rent it out. The value of the house will go up. I'll sell it in 3 or 5 years. I'll collect all this income and then I'll make a bunch of money on selling the house. Well, that worked right up until it didn't. And so people were doing that 03, 04, 05, 06, 07. And all of a sudden it
hit a wall. Was this mainly only happening in America then?
It happened all over the world.
Oh, so all over the world, people are buying houses when they really shouldn't have been.
Yes, but America was probably the worst at it during that time.
Why was everyone doing that in the world? Why had rules all of a sudden become lenient?
Because we forget the past. What's that old saying? If you forget the past, you're bound to repeat it. This happened the Great Depression in the US, which was in the late 20s, you know, late 1920s. A very similar thing happened. They made lending money very easy. Lots of people took advantage of it, borrowed the money. And then the assets, you know, you're buying homes, the value of the house went up. Well, suddenly it just came crashing down. If you get bored this week, Google Iceland in 2008, they had some very, you know, this destroyed banks. It destroyed people's credit. It destroyed real estate. It was amazing. And then many firms on Wall Street would take these mortgages. So if you buy a mortgage, I'll make up the number, $300,000, and you have this, you're paying this money into it to pay it back. People take that income stream and they package it up with other mortgages and sell it as an investment product. And so that was going on as well. So Wall Street was making a lot of money doing that.
Yeah.
My firm was not in that business. I'm very happy to report, but we bought some of those investments and they turned out to be very bad. And we had some very painful period in 08 where things were bad. And that was actually the first time I'm pretty sure that we ever had an actual layoff where we said we need to get rid of 5% of our people or 10% or something like this at the time. I think it was 8.
Yeah.
It was brutal and business dried up for a couple years in there. Again, and you were constantly looking over your shoulder thinking, am I going to get let go here?
And as a Wall Street, especially now, this when they talk about the 08 crash, it's always, you know, it was the bankers. They did this, they did that, they cheated people, etc. You were a Wall Street guy at the time. Did you, as a Wall Street guy, sometimes feel the wrath of other people when they found out that you were a Wall Street guy? Like they were, because at that time, they were probably, was the blame on Wall Street? And so anyone associated with Wall Street was all of a sudden a bad person?
That certainly existed. You know, as I mentioned, my firm fortunately wasn't in this business playing this funky game. So that, I guess, made me a bit immune to that. But the government let the rules too lax. Wall Street took far too much advantage of it. And people took too much advantage of it. Look, you know, at some point, we also have to take personal responsibility. If your net worth is $100,000 and you've taken out mortgages for $2 million, is that someone else's fault that you did that?
Well, yeah, I feel like especially these days, and anytime when there's a problem, I mean, you did it yourself when you were struggling and you were in a stall, you were sort of blaming everything else apart from yourself. And I think we as humans, we like to sort of blame all. That's why the whole bankers thing gets pushed around all. I don't know if you ever hear that. I don't know if that's just a UK term, bankers, where it's like, oh, it's the bankers' fault. The bankers did it in a way. The bankers crashed us in a way. And they benefited off it or whatever it was. And we sort of don't want to take personal responsibility. But if you buy a house that's worth $1 million and you're not earning, you know, you're earning a basic salary, you know, it's probably not the smartest idea. So is that, would you say it's wrong to sort of blame the bankers and it's all a mix of responsibility from a load of different factors?
I think it was all three parties.
Yeah.
The government made it too easy. The bankers, to use your term, took too far much advantage of that easy regulation, and individuals took too much advantage. And, you know, not to say some of them weren't, you know, overpromised or oversold something. I'm sure those circumstances happened, but I'm also quite sure that people knew exactly what they were doing and saying, I probably shouldn't be doing this, but I have access to it. So everyone's making money doing it, so I'll do it, right? You know, just because you can go eat at McDonald's every day, is that a good idea?
Right? Exactly, yeah, personal responsibility. So, I mean, a few years on from that, you become, like you said, in 2014, I think you said, that you became a Wall Street senior vice president. You'd worked hard, you'd done the survey thing, you know, you'd use that to sort of improve yourself and to improve your sort of relationship with your clients. What was the process like of applying for that position, getting it, and, you know, what motivated you to go, you know what, I'm going to go for this big position?
You know, my whole life, I'd always been in some kind of different leadership roles, captain of soccer teams and things like this, and, you know, clubs in school. I was often leadership just, I've always had this sort of unique ability, I guess, to sort of recognize the bigger playing field of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then always felt very passionate to help others sort of come with me, if you will, on the journey or help them along. And so after, you know, at that point, I'd been with the firm about 15 or 16 years. And thought, you know, here's a good chance for me to grow and continue to challenge myself and, you know, move into a leadership role and you know, hopefully help the company out more. And so it was motivated really by that. And then, you know, I interviewed for that role. I think I said earlier, I was interviewing for grad school, business school at the same time down in Florida. I actually got accepted to business school down there. I went for one day and then dropped out because I got the job offer. but I had to go through several rounds of interviews. I don't even remember how many, 4 or 5 rounds of interviews to get that role. And then landed that position. And then suddenly I went from being people's peer to their boss, which is a unique circumstance.
Yeah.
And several people applied for that same job. One of them was now a direct report of mine. So imagine this, you and me are competing for the same job. I get it. Now I'm your boss.
Yeah, that must have been probably not the best position.
It was a little awkward. And so I reached out to him right away and said, hey, you know, I'm sure you're a great candidate. For whatever reason, they chose you over me. I just want to get this on the table because we're going to be working together and I want to make sure everything's good. And I'm really glad I made that call because that kind of opened the, instead of leaving it this awkward thing we didn't talk about, I put it right on the table and that helped us.
Again, and I think it says a lot about your personality as well there, John, because it's again, another example of where you've sort of gone out there and done something that not a lot of people would have done. And I know for you that it might seem, no, everyone would have done that. But from my perspective, it seems like you do things that not everyone wants to do. You know, you're willing to sort of get that feedback, even though you know it could, you know, punch you in the stomach. You're willing to sort of speak to the candidate that you were up against, that you were in competition with just the other day. Now you're his boss. You act like a real leader and not, you know, an idiot and, you know, a jerk, as you might say. I was going to say knobhead, but I was realized you're probably not used to that term. So I'll use the American term of a jerk, which just seems weird to say. It was really weird to say that. And you know, you're being a real leader and you're going up to him and you go, listen, you know, for whatever reason I got the job, you're being humble there by saying for whatever reason, and you know, you're developing a good relationship with them so you can just continue on. It is fascinating and it's good to hear because it's an example of getting promoted to something like Wall Street Senior VP, but also being a good person throughout or trying to be a good person throughout. I think a lot of people believe in the whole idea of a good guy's finish last or whatever. But this is a constant example where you are doing things to improve yourself and you're doing them in a way where you are still being the best possible human being.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I remember seeing early on in my career, one of the guys who we all sitting in these cubes in this big floor in the World Trade Center. So there's, you know, 100 people on the floor, whatever it was, everyone's on headsets, right? I remember seeing this one guy get promoted and he was already, you know, a knobhead to use your term. And this, I'm not kidding you. He gets called in to get this promotion. He comes out of the office and now he's got this new status. And the first thing he did was take his like busy work, his kind of, you know, sort of the low end work they had to do. And he dumped it on the guy's desk right next to him. I mean, I remember seeing that and thinking, man, I never want to be that guy. Like what an idiot. And fortunately I didn't see too many of those examples in my life, but you know, I never wanted to be that person. And and I tried to take that approach into my leadership role.
So before we get on to talking about your book, which I really want to hear more about, I just want to stick with the senior VP position. I keep saying VP position, right? What, as senior VP, you're now sort of, like you said, you're in charge of your peers now. In terms of that role, what does that entail? And how far away is it from the top job that you can get on Wall Street, wherever the top job is?
So the keys to the role were, one, leading and coaching the team, helping them grow. Two, helping design the strategic business plan for the department, for your team. And three, working with your top clients. So you had a client relationship duty as well. So instead of now calling on, as a salesperson, you're calling on, we called on financial advisors. So financial advisors at UBS and Wells Fargo and Merrill Lynch and these big banks. Now, instead of calling on the financial advisors, we were calling on the managers of their companies. So I would call on like a regional manager for Morgan Stanley or something like this, or JP Morgan or what have you. So it was a three-pronged approach, helping guide and lead your team, helping build a strategic plan, and then working with the clients to kind of help create access for your team members. In terms of how many steps away from the CEO of the company, I guess I was three steps down from that, four, something like that. So
why didn't you carry on going then?
Well, in summer of 2019, our company got sold to a much bigger competitor, and the firm wanted to cut costs, quite frankly, that bought us. And so they offered really attractive deals to leave, quite frankly. And so they said, would you like a kind of mediocre deal to stick around or a really good deal to leave? And I thought, I think I'm going to go. Yeah. So off I went.
Was there not a part of you that thought, I've gotten all the way here, I want to get to the top, even if it's just for a little to get to the top, just so I know I've gotten to the top?
Yeah, there was part of me that wanted to stay. But at the same time, it was a new firm coming in. It was a different culture. It's a different organization. And as I said, the deal to leave was pretty attractive. So it wasn't terribly hard of a choice for me.
And so what did you go on to do after that?
So immediately after this, so now it's the summer of 19, having worked right out of college for 23 years, I took a bunch of vacations.
Nice. Yeah. I'm glad to hear, John.
Yeah, I never had this kind of time, you know, so we went and took a few really fun trips to California and to the beach and stuff like this.
What's the best place you went to?
Oh man, California was awesome. We did a 14-day trip through California, and man, that was a blast.
Really, Americans are so lucky because it's all in one country. You can literally go from one end to the other. It's like different worlds.
Yeah, it really, California is totally different than, I live in the East Coast by DC, and so different. But yeah, so I spent the summer just kind of like having fun with my family and traveling around. It was great. And then in the fall, got into this sort of back into networking and what am I going to do next kind of thing. And that's when I started writing this paper we talked, I think, about earlier. And that turned into the book, and which has now turned into this little coaching and consulting business I've been working on.
So I know, because you never sort of set out to write a book, you don't really have a reason as to why you wrote the book. But can I still ask you that? Why you wanted to write a book?
Well, part of it was that, you know, I was given all this encouragement and people told me, like, you have a real story here to tell. And I didn't really think about it as such. And so when my professor, who's a very bright guy, said, hey, I think you've got the makings of a book here, that was a huge kind of boost for, you know, if he's telling me this, you know, I think I'm actually, I don't think he said that to me for fun, you know, like he had a real reason for saying it, because he had read my papers I had written at the series. So he really inspired me. And then I started to talk to more and more people about it and a little bit about nuggets about my story, and realized, like, this whole feedback loop I talked about. I was sitting at lunch with a friend who's an executive at a pretty big firm. And I remember telling her this feedback loop story. So I talked about it earlier with clients. I use that same concept as a leader. So I would call up my team members and say, hey, Tariq, I'm thinking about doing this with a change or trying to better help our team better communicate. What would you do if you were me? How could I better help our team communicate together? And I have to tell you, those questions really, people, they're very uncomfortable questions. Or what's it like working with me? How could I improve our working relationship? Those questions really freak people out because they're not used to them. And they were like, what is your angle? What are you getting at? I think people early on thought, here's a guy trying, maybe he's trying to get some information on me so he can fire me or something like this.
Yeah, it is a bit of a weird question though. Like, you don't hear it often.
So it took people a while to get used to that. And I had to prove to them that I was asking these questions for real reasons and through my actions, not my words. You can tell people all you want that you're going to do something good. Well, until you actually do it, nobody really cares or believes you, right? And so back to this executive friend, I'm sitting at lunch with her January of last year. And so I told her this story about the feedback loop and the pain in her face of thinking about having this conversation with her direct reports or her boss. I mean, she turned almost like white. I mean, the pain in her face of considering this conversation with her boss or her employees made me realize I was really onto something. If it made someone that uncomfortable, then I thought I had something here.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, like your professor said, you do. I think it's like people that have interesting stories don't necessarily think that they've got interesting stories to tell. Like for you, it was probably just like, oh, I just sort of live my life and whatever. But I think the book sort of made you reflect, and you mentioned in the podcast, you know, how a huge part of your life, or sort of by looking or having an overview of your life, you realize that a huge part of it was to push yourself out of your comfort zone and getting out there and putting yourself out there. And it's interesting because someone I had recently on the podcast, Terry, she's been doing marketing for a long time, and she said one of the things that you really need to do is, if you want to get these promotions, you need to put yourself out there to your manager, your boss, whoever your higher up is, and go, listen, if I want the next job up, let's say it becomes available, you know, what do I need to do? How do I get there? And it's something that isn't necessarily taught, because especially in school, the whole point of school or the way you're taught in school is, oh, just work harder and you'll get good grades. But in life, it's not like that. If you work hard at a job, and again, something that you mentioned in the podcast, it's about working smart too. You can work as hard, you can be the hardest work in the world and not get promoted if you don't work smart. And I think your story is interesting because of that. It's about working hard and working smart, developing good relationships, and probably most of all, I'd probably say being a decent human being.
Well, thank you. And I would really add this, getting outside your comfort zone. I mean, asking people for feedback, you're making yourself very vulnerable. And as I said, you hear things you don't want to hear, but this is how you grow. And like early on when I went and worked for the film festival and helped them raise money and get Jameson, that whole story, I mean, that was completely outside of my comfort zone. And going to Florida to do a presentation as a 25-year-old for 300 people, I vividly remember breakfast. I could not eat that morning. I was so nervous, I couldn't eat breakfast. So I'm sitting at this breakfast table with all these people I'm about to present to. And they're like, oh, are you not hungry? And I was, you know, I was so nervous I couldn't eat.
Yeah,
my stomach was just like turning in knots, you know? That nerve-wracking experience helped me grow. And so to specifically answer your question, why did I write the book? One of the big themes in it is I found so many people in my career and now in this coaching work I'm doing that never really they never unleash their gifts to the world and their skills. And what I found was, as I reflected on this in the paper and writing in the book, and as I started thinking about the book, was they don't, with change or trying something new comes these emotional boundaries, fear, loss, uncertainty, shame, all of these things can be this roller coaster. And so what I try to do as a leader is break through that and help people get past that emotional charge, if you could, and build systems and relationships where we could overcome those more easily. But more importantly, what I found the way to do it systematically is to get people to think in this constant state of change, constantly allocating some level of their business plan. You know, maybe it's an hour a week. It doesn't have to be 10 hours a week. It may be 1 hour a week to thinking about, how do I improve a process, a system, a product, whatever it is, and constantly allocating time to that and putting it in your business plan. Hey, this year, I'm going to try to work on this differently. And I would try to help them unearth what that thing was. I didn't want to ever come to someone and say, hey, Tariq, you're really bad at this, so work on this for a while. Like, nobody wants to hear that, right?
Exactly.
But what I do, see this?
Yeah. What?
This
why,
is, how? This is,
note, just for audio listeners, it's a post-it note.
Yeah.
What, why, and how on the post-it note.
That has been sitting on my computer screen for years, probably 7, 8, 9 years. And it was a reminder to me as a leader to constantly be asking, because I coached a remote team long before the pandemic. It was a constant reminder to me to ask them questions, because when you ask people what, why, how, you're really empowering them to take ownership of the decision. Instead of calling me up and saying, hey, John, how do I solve this or that? I would say, well, what have you tried so far? Why did you take that approach? How is it working out so far? What could you do differently? As opposed to saying, hey, call this person and figure it out. I was trying to, this whole teach a man to fish thing, right? Give a man a fish, they eat for a day.
Yeah.
Teach them to fish, they eat for a lifetime. And so I was always trying to teach people how to fish and grow as leaders. And even if they never got into a leadership role, if they took on that leadership mindset of constantly evolving and developing things, it made them much more valuable to the company and to themselves, quite frankly.
Oh yeah, like you, by doing that and having that experience, you enrich a person. And like the quote is it's about teaching a man how to fish, not just, and a woman and a person how to fish, not just teaching them how to, or not just giving them the fish.
Exactly.
Throughout this podcast, we have talked about what you've done, how you've done it, and why you've done it throughout the whole thing. And my final question to you is, as someone that has had such a huge amount of experience in almost in life, I would say, and I wouldn't say you've had all the experience in life, because there's still yet more to be discovered, and I'm sure you're still asking the question of what is John Saunders 9.0. you know, I'm sure that's the next question you're asking yourself. But for a 19-year-old like myself, and my viewers and listeners being young people, what advice would you sort of give for them to live a fulfilling life, but also a life where they can be an effective leader, build trust with their colleagues, and not in a leader as in they have to be a leader in their company, but just being someone that other people want to be around and have trust with them and build trust with those people?
There's a lot of that question there, but I like
sorry
it.
Sorry about that.
No,
it's just final question.
No, I appreciate that. I think if there were two big themes, maybe three, I would say be curious. You know, keep learning, keep digging into things. You know, when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do next, you know, as I think I mentioned earlier, this woman said, go immerse yourself in something. And I just kept going to these events and meeting these people and networking and so what's going on with this industry or that. And honestly, that's how I landed my first client. I was just talking to a guy at a networking event and asking him questions about his business and being curious. And he said, could you come do this for my company? And I said, do what? I'm just talking to you. Yeah. It was kind of funny, actually. And so he ended up, his company ended up being my first client. And so it happened because I was out there meeting people, talking to people, learning and growing. So be curious. Don't be afraid to ask people for help. People are willing to help you. And, you know, I've been working as a mentor in my school for a number of years. And so it's more of a formal thing, but there are so many people out there willing to help. Don't be afraid to ask for it, but also be prepared. So when you go talk to that person, just don't put the entire conversation on them. You know, be prepared, learn about that person, learn about what it is they do and how they could maybe help you, and reach out to them. Hey, I'm trying to figure this out. Could you help me out? Could we have a 30-minute conversation to talk about for me to learn about this or that, whatever it is, your industry, your career, whatever it is. And as you said, you know, be humble. You know, it's a tough world out there. We've all got challenges. And the more we can be humble and respect others, I think is just super important.
And what a great way to end a great podcast. If you'd like to purchase John's book, then you can order it using the link below. I'll also leave the link to John's website on there. I can't wait to read it. I need to get it ordered, and I can't wait to just give it a read. It was incredible. It was just great to sort of hear John's story. Not only how he became successful as a businessman, but also just as a human being, you know, the things he did to improve, the things he did to develop himself and become a better person, become a better leader, and his humility behind it all. I mean, he said it right at the end, you know, the key is to be humble. And I think it's something that I definitely can learn from. And I hope everyone that managed to stay till the end could learn from as well. If you did manage to stay till the end, please do let me know in the comments below. Smash the like button and stay subscribed for next week's episode. Yes, next week's episode. Actually, no, sorry. Before next week's episode, we're going to have a bit of a bonus episode where I sit with networking expert Terry, who tells me about how to network, how we can get into, get those promotions that we're so desperately looking for, and how we can do all this and achieve success on our own terms. It was another very interesting one. It's more about sort of what we can learn about networking and how we can just you know, how we can develop and climb up the ladder. We all sort of talk about it as young people, how we want to improve, how we want to get to, you know, A, B, C or whatever. And it was definitely something that I'm definitely going to take into account when I'm applying for future jobs or when I've got a proper job, hopefully after I graduate. But other than that, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week. I'll see you on Wednesday. Until next time.